Well, these four sessions are about worldviews, really, and we introduced that last week. I think this week is not so dense or intense, so I think there will be a bit more space for you to speak into. Last week was a real whiz through the Christian worldview. We had a little bit about how people think in general and how thinking influences behaviour and responses and attitudes about all kinds of things. But we mainly concentrated on the Christian worldview, which we defined in that way, creation, fall, redemption, glory. Having had a look at the material again, I'm sure you won't even have noticed, but I tweaked week two and week three. So this week, if you were coming expecting existentialism and postmodernism, we're going to do that next week, whereas this week we're going to look at secular materialism and intolerance, which, believe it or not, is slightly easier than existentialism and postmodernism. So that's what we're about. There are some handouts. It's up to you whether you want the handouts now, whether you want them at the end, but we've got all the slides on. If you want them now, that's fine. I'll try not to read the slides. It looks like there's quite a lot of slides, but actually there's a lot of builds, a lot of repetition. So I think we'll get through reasonably quick. So, why doesn't someone tell me, who was here last week, a few words, other than just the four words, about a Christian worldview? What are the four main elements of a Christian worldview? Someone say the first word.
God.
No, creation.
He created the world.
Yes, God created the world. That would be fine. Did he create the world using pre-existing materials? Okay. What was the means he used for creating the world? His words? Yeah, sure. So, there's lots of other things that we looked at last week in terms of the doctrine of creation and how that affects our view of man and the dignity of man and the value of man. But that was creation. Next word?
Fall.
And what do we say about fall? The fall. It led to alienation, yes.
I was about to
say the consequences of it. Yes, there were the consequences of it. What about the elements of it, of the fall?
You mean the mistrust,
Deception? Well, there was deception. What is the kind of process? We talked about it a little bit, actually, on Sunday evening, if you were here for the preaching.
God's goodness and promises.
Yeah, questioning God's goodness. Questioning God's promises is another way of saying questioning God's rule or word, trustworthiness, all those things. What else? What did Adam and Eve want to be? They wanted to be gods. So they wanted to be like God. That was the offer. They would be like God. So they mistrusted God's word, mistrusted God's goodness. They wanted to be like God. And what were they driven by? Yeah.
Desire.
Yeah. It took me a while to kind of notice that in the creation story. You know when Eve looks and sees that it was desirable for making wise? And I hadn't particularly kind of majored on that word desirable until you kind of think about it. And think, actually, yeah, she is the kind of prototype, and then Adam after her, of being enslaved to sin, enslaved by sin. You desire it, and it rules over you. So that's the fall. So that also influences how we think. Man, woman, made in God's image, dignified, valued, like God in many ways, not to be destroyed, not to be killed, not to be murdered, but at the same time fallen, broken, and the world they live in is broken. So there will be great disappointments and there will be death. So fall, third element of Christian worldview is... Do you know anything about redemption? What's the word mean?
To buy back.
To buy back? How did God do that?
He died on the cross and gave us our redemption.
Yeah, Jesus died on the cross, paid the penalty for our sins. defeated the accusations of Satan and set us free. So that's redemption. And we live somewhere along that line towards glory. Anything you can say about glory?
Creation restored.
It is creation restored, not completely replaced. Yeah, the absence of the consequences of the fall. It's eternal, being in the presence of God. And you might want to be there, maybe, on your good days. So, that's a Christian worldview. And when we're thinking about what we're thinking about tonight, it'd be good to kind of bear that in mind. So, let's think for a moment about a secular worldview, which begins with our idea about creation. And what we're looking at, I don't really know how to define it. You can define it as materialism and all kinds of other things. But fundamentally, what we're looking at tonight could be defined as the belief that all in nature that exists and everything that's supernatural couldn't possibly exist. The material is all that exists. So any mental properties that there might be, any mental powers or anything like that, any sense of the self or consciousness, those kinds of things, the spirit, the effects of the mind, they're just constructions of materials. So that's the fundamental materialistic view. So there is nothing except for matter and material. Anything else is, in essence, a construction. So your sense of self sitting here, because you don't think you're me, do you? You think you're you, and you think that in some way, although intricately connected to your body, your self is separate from your body. I think we do. I don't think I'm my hand. I think I'm connected to my hand, but I don't think I am my hand. Do you? It's kind of me, but it's not me. There's a separateness of self. This is even not what it's about tonight, but you're all looking a bit mystified, so I thought I'd carry on for a bit. But that's naturalism, and obviously lots of things flow from it, so you could call it a secular materialistic view or naturalism. And if you get into the depths of it, there's lots of different kind of sub-definitions of naturalism, but we're not going to look in those in any great detail. We're just going to dissect it and then start to try and sort of work through it with a Christian worldview in mind. Anything anyone wants to ask about a secular view of creation? Secular view of the fall would be that we live in a random universe, and bad stuff that happens is this sort of random universe fighting for survival. Another sort of related definition of evil might be religion, and the sort of enslaving people with religious notions is a definition of evil. Of course, we all know there's inconsistencies in even saying that, but probably an adamant secular materialist view would be that religion is a bad thing, and the bad stuff that happens in the world, in a way including that, is just a result of random chemicals combining. Redemption, there really isn't any, but you could say redemption might be something like the world being saved by getting rid of religion. And we kind of all just live for the moment and for self. Of course, there's slight modifications of that, we kind of, life has its own purpose, and maybe it might be a nice thing not to kill everyone else off so we can live. But there are inconsistencies, of course, in that, but that would be a general view. You live life for its own purpose and you try and help everyone else to live life to the full. Because that's the only purpose there is living. Oh, sorry, gone too many. And glory, there really isn't any. But perhaps glory might be just personal moments of meaningless achievement. I don't know really how else to define it. That would be the view. That glory is either there isn't any, because there's no afterlife, or if there's glory at all, it's in the moment. It's that moment of achievement. It's the winning the medal. It's the going out with the girl you've always loved. It's the whatever, climbing the mountain, passing your 11 plus. Pardon?
There's no harm in that.
There's absolutely no harm in that. But is that the aim of life? Is that the goal of life?
Well, not necessarily.
No.
In the big scheme of things, it's not. No.
Absolutely. And of course, if you've got a Christian worldview about man, then you'll embrace those things and think, wow, these are great gifts from God, and I want to live life to the full, but for his glory, with the future glory in mind. So I'm just constraining into the narrow category of thinking about what's kind of ultimate glory, and I think that would be the materialistic view. And I don't think it's really a good one. But we'll see. So we're going to have lots of slides that look a bit like this. And I've got small print here, so I need my goggles, or I'm going to be fumbling around. There we go. Man, these glasses are good. I can actually see stuff now. Okay, so any worldview has to explain reality. So what we're going to do, we're going to kind of think about the Christian worldview in a slightly more extended way, and how it relates to the world and how it relates to us, and kind of demolish it one by one to get to the secular materialist worldview. I think it's quite an interesting exercise. Christian worldview begins with the idea that the prime reality is God. You can read the slides, but it begins with God, transcendent, immanent, meaning although he's beyond us and above us, he's also close to us. He knows everything, he's completely sovereign, completely in charge, and he is good. So that's the Christian worldview about God, and that God created the universe out of nothing, ex nihilo, just means out of nothing, to operate with a uniformity of cause and effect in an open system. Don't worry too much about the terminology, but that's a Christian worldview of that. Human beings are created in the image of God, so we possess personality, self-transcendence, we're not our hand, intelligence to varying degrees, morality, gregariousness, and creativity. So that's us humans. For each person, for all of us, is that just disappearing off the top? Or is that... We'll go down a bit, shall we? Gateway to life with God, or gateway to eternal punishment. That's what the end of life is. In terms of knowledge, human beings, we can know the world around them, and we can know God himself, because God's built into us the capacity to do so, and he takes an active role in communicating with us. Ethics, in other words, how we live, is transcendent. In other words, it's outside ourselves. We only know how to live because God reveals it to us. So it's not something we construct ourselves. It's based on the character of God, who is both holy and loving. And then history is linear. It's a meaningful sequence of events. It's not progressive in the sense I was talking about last week, that sometimes, and I think Mark mentioned it on Sunday morning as well, it's not progressive in the sense that we're getting better and better and cleverer, but it is progressive in the sense that it's moving towards ultimate glory. It is moving according to God's plan. So let's just demolish that, which won't take as long as it looks from the number of slides there are. So we start off with that prime reality that we already defined, that God is the first cause and is intimately involved with his creation. And in that kind of time period, which it's not kind of supposed to be particularly accurate, but there was a real movement around that in the 18th century, in moving from what we would call theism to deism, a kind of a generalized belief in God. So this is how kind of beliefs collapsed during that period. And I think it's just helpful to think about that because it helps us understand where we are now. And it's very simplified, but it gives you a kind of grasp on it. So the view that began to become more current was that, yeah, God was the first cause, but kind of he leaves it to run on its own. So there is a reality of God, but he creates the world and then kind of leaves it to run on its own. We said in the Christian worldview he created it out of nothing, but the deistic kind of view would say that, yes, God did create the world, and it has got kind of rules, and it does kind of operate within those rules, but those rules are always kept, so you can't have miracles, because God sets the world up, kind of winds it all up, and off it goes, and you can't really have miracles, because God is not intervening and progressing history. Human beings created in the image of God, possessing personality and all those things that we mentioned before, kind of move towards the view that human beings, although they're personal, it will be said, are just part of this kind of clockwork of the universe. As we said, that death is the gateway to either eternal life or eternal punishment. Sorry, we're moving fast, so don't worry. Well, there may be. Maybe the way they were printed out. Sorry if they are.
No,
a little bit skew with.
The animation.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Blue, which is what it was in the original one,
and then
it changes.
So does it? I thought it only highlighted the pink, but I may have done it wrong. Sorry if I did.
We don't have the blue one each.
You don't have the blue one. You're not supposed to.
No.
Because it was a repeat of the previous one, so I thought it was a bit of a waste of slides. Because of the creation mandate to rule and subdue the world, I'm saving paper. So the view that kind of moved towards during that period was that there's possibly an afterlife. There might be an afterlife. Next view, human beings can know the world around them and God himself because God's built them, and that we talked about by communicating with them. Came to be more of a view that the world is kind of all right. That it's understood to be normal, it's not really fallen or abnormal or damaged, and we can know what the universe is like and we can know what God is like just by studying the world. Ethics is to be understood by revelation. Would be the Christian view, which kind of moved towards you can kind of figure it out from looking at the world. So you can work out ethics, how you live, by looking in the world. That's really what reveals what's right. It's kind of what's natural. And then finally, in terms of history, which the Christian worldview would be that it's linear. But the deistic worldview, because the world was kind of set off in the beginning and God wasn't so close to it all, it is determined, it is kind of going somewhere, but it's kind of just left to trundle along and get there. Now, I don't know if you found that helpful, but I did. So we've demolished quite a bit. So we're kind of there in the beginning of the 19th century. And although there were some revivals, and some significant changes to people's worldview, that was a quite strong embedded view, which of course made our culture more receptive in lots of ways when the idea of natural selection and evolution comes along. So we've got from theism, Christian worldview, to deism. God's there, he made the world, probably, and there might be an afterlife, but he's not really imminent and involved, and we're probably not fallen. We might be essentially good, and that we can just figure everything out by studying enough. But that moved more from deism to naturalism. If I go through that, and then there's lots of time to kick around in a minute, so I'll just purge my way through that bit as well. So, we've got a kind of deistic view, that's what's up on those white ones now, and we're just going to demolish those a bit. So, taking the prime reality, we get rid of that. And we say that there is no first cause, that matter exists eternally, and it's all there is. All there is matter. We can get into discussions about Big Bang and all that in a minute, but essentially that's the view, that all there is matter, and that it's self-existent and self-creating, and that God doesn't exist. There we go. And then the cosmos, the world, which we would say was created by God and God is involved in it, the materialistic worldview would be that it's just it's uniform, it's cause and effect, it's not going anywhere, and it kind of explains itself and just interacts with itself. So it's a closed system in that sense. Then in terms of human beings, moving from a sense that they're kind of personal but part of the clockwork universe, would be that we're complex but we're just machines. Personality is just a chemical physical thing. We might not understand it, but eventually we will. But we'll be able to explain it mechanically, electronically, chemically, or something like that. From possibly an afterlife, you know what's coming. Death is the extinction of life, personality, individuality. There's no soul, there's no spirit that continues beyond the death of the body. And history is just a whole series of cause and effect. There is no purpose. There might be progress because we get cleverer, but there's no purpose in that. We may consider ourselves better than previous generation, but it's not as though we're going anywhere. We may be better, we may be worse, but it's all meaningless without any purpose. Let's think about the world, that having thought perhaps it's not fallen, our knowledge of the world is either identical with, or like it is the brain itself, or it's a byproduct of the brain. So matter is really clever, however you define clever, and has created this kind of false impression of consciousness and knowledge. But in a sense, knowledge doesn't really exist, as we'll see in a minute. Ethics, the way we do stuff, it's related only to human beings, and values are purely human constructs. That wasn't too painful, was it? So that really, overall, is the materialistic worldview. So matter is all there is. It's just this closed system. History is going nowhere. It's just a series of events. We know stuff, but in a sense it's all a bit of an illusion. We are machines. The way we live our lives is entirely for us to decide. And at the end of life, it's all over and there is nothing else. Yeah, that's a good question. It's probably a good point to say that obviously these things are complicated in that probably no one's a pure materialist in practice, partly because of the inconsistencies. So it's not as though we, say, as a nation, were entirely theist and then became deist and then became more sort of secular naturalists. But I suppose there's broad percentages. I mean, everyone would say that the coming along of Darwin wasn't just that it was, you know, a really good, compelling set of theories. It was that it falls on the kind of fertile ground of people for all kinds of reasons being quite willing to jettison the need for God. But I don't think that meant in 1850, whatever it was, that we all suddenly became naturalists, because obviously there's such an overhang of Christian heritage complicated by lots of tradition and stuff, so it's difficult to work out what everyone was thinking. And then you've got lots of wars, particularly the two world wars, which although seemed to have a religious resurgence, sort of, you know, people were going to churches and stuff, I think most observers think that the two world wars were actually kind of almost the end of Christianity in this country. That the final sort of consequence of those two world wars was the sort of, the end of a Christian worldview and the sort of beginning of the end of an even vaguely sort of God worldview. Does that make sense? So I think we're talking about maybe the 100 years after Darwin would be the sort of, I suppose, the rise of naturalism. But it's worth just keep saying, when we look at the other views as well in the next few weeks, that probably no one's a purist about these things. So you might be kind of halfway along that track, which is why it's worth sort of tracing it out. So you can trace out historically, you know, the general view, and you would recognise that view from, I know it gets overused, but a Richard Dawkins or something, as that's the kind of fully fledged view. Most people kind of pick and choose other bits. So you might pick a bit of New Age philosophy and mix it in, or what we'll look at next week in terms of existentialism and kind of mould it in a way. So no one really walks around saying, I'm a sexual materialist. Once I've said sex, I just keep saying it again. It's one of those kind of things that you just sort of, you know, anyway, there we go. And of course, Christians, as I was saying last week, can also end up picking and choosing various bits of a non-Christian worldview and kind of tacking them onto their own view. Does anyone want to speak to that question?
Well-known proponents of deism in Italy.
That's a really good question, and I don't know the answer. I'll answer you next week on that.
The only deist I've ever heard of is Neil Armstrong. He was one, but that
yes.
was way off.
I was just trying to think of whether some of the American leaders were actually more kind of worked through. Someone like Benjamin Franklin or somebody, but no, I'm not skilled enough to know. Does that sound about right? Thomas Jefferson. Yeah. If you read books on revivals, like the George Whitfield revival kind of type books, they would talk a lot about the kind of prevalence of the view. But I don't think they particularly talk about any great leaders of the view, whether it just kind of seeped in, or whether there were people who kind of stood up and said, I'm a deist and this is my philosophy. I don't think it kind of worked like that, really. But bear in mind on these things, I'm not an expert. I just done a little bit more preparation than you have. So there could well be answers you have that I don't have, so feel free to shout up. Any other sort of questions on the fundamentals or thoughts about it before we think a little bit more about critiquing it?
If it's been a progressive
thing,
it's a simple question.
Yes.
So where do you think things are moving from naturalism? I mean, by definition,
no. Yeah, I think it has lots of children because, in a way, it gives birth to what we'll look at next week in terms of existentialism. That experience then becomes the valuable thing. So you've got to have lots of experiences, and that's kind of what defines you. But if we get into it in a minute, critiquing it, it does lead to hopelessness. So hopelessness and insecurity is part of our culture as well. So that drives people in other directions, either to seeking either to be anaesthetized or excessive pleasure-seeking in some way or form. it leads to a kind of breaking down of all moral values because they're just human constructs. It breaks down the distinction, I think, between humans and animals, which I know in a kind of flippant way sometimes I joke about animals, rabbits or whatever, it's not always very helpful, but that distinction between humans and animals is much more blurred. So I know we know this, but you know, people might get outraged about someone dumping a cat in the bin or something because they want to get rid of it, but they don't get outraged about dumping a baby in the bin. But that's an outcome of thinking of breaking down, thinking of as just machines, which, and we happen to have evolved this way and they've evolved this way. So we can place a value on spiders if we want, which is equal or even greater than humans. You know, what's to stop us doing that?
I
had some more children, but I'll have to keep them in mind. No, you're right. Keep going.
I was just thinking, if we've now got to the point where God does not exist,
yeah,
then there's going to have to be a major shift in terms of, I would say, a degrading progress in the world.
Yes. Yeah.
I think once you've denied the existence of God, I'm not sure there can be any further massive shift. It's just like you said,
sure,
where there's hopelessness, so let's seek pleasure where we can.
Yeah.
I mean,
wrong. Yeah. Bear in mind across the world that religion is not on the decline. So although this is a very prevalent worldview across the world, it's not the only worldview. And so we're very much constrained by our kind of Western culture and experience, but that's not, you know, in terms of numbers, religion's not really on the decline across the world. That was something else I was going to say about consequences. Yeah, just to I don't know if you alluded to it, Simon, but it opens up all those thoughts about artificial intelligence. So if we are just machines, then being able to create consciousness must be possible, which is the big kind of goal of artificial intelligence, is to create a sense of self in this machine. I'm really, really not qualified to speak into it, but those who are kind of really into Christian philosophy would say that the debate over consciousness is like it could be the paradigm shift that actually moves people back more to a Christian worldview, because there is no, we'll talk about it actually a little bit later on, but there's no explanation for consciousness. And people who are just biologists kind of get into it, but actually people who are philosophers, even non-Christian philosophers, would recognize the problem of personhood in terms of an evolutionary view. But we'll think about that in a minute. Yeah.
People who are really higher on the mainstream thinking, and they, from the little bit I've heard on the radio, are more inclined to say if it ever happens at all, we're a long, long, long.
Yes.
Long.
Yeah.
Deny
no.
But they're not as confident or upbeat or
yes. Yeah. I think, though, we should expect as Christians that it would not be possible to, in a sense, replicate the soul. I think that's a fair view to take.
Yes.
Yeah. 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 Yes. Yeah. Yeah, but
would you put the increasing number of children who reach the point of total despair?
Yeah, yeah.
Commit suicide.
Sure.
Which is a very modern phenomenon.
Yes.
In our society.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, pessimism is, I think we might think about it, or we're thinking about it now, but we can think about it later as well, about the hopelessness of this view. I was thinking of something else when you said something just then, which might have been useful, but it might not. Can't remember. It will come back to me. But I've got consciousness, but I don't always have a perfect working brain. But I've got a real sense of self, but self is not always behaving itself in quite the way that it should. Okay, so what would be... Yes, of course. Keep going. Yeah.
And stem cell research, and it would appear that God is allowing that development and that progress because he's giving consciousness, he's allowing
sure.
two cells that would otherwise not have met through natural reproduction to combine, and he is allowing that consciousness to be created.
Sure. Yes. Yeah. But I suppose it is just analogous to the sexual way of conceiving, isn't it? In the sense that God allows that process of the combination of cells, whatever you call those things. what do you call them? Yeah, those combination of those two halves. To make a cell, he allows that very chemical, biological process to produce a person. It just happens to be that means. Pardon? Sure. So I think it's a really good and helpful point, which actually speaks to lots of other issues. But it doesn't seem too much of a stretch to think, well, God could allow that to happen outside of the womb as much as inside for that process to happen, because it's still a biological thing that somehow God injects with a personhood and stamps his image. The reason that's a really important question to think about, because it speaks to, of course, you know, very early terminations and fertility treatment, all those kind of things. It kind of speaks to that, to think I don't want to have a big debate about that now, but you've got to think, okay, so if I believe that God does invest with this combination of things to make a cell and then division of cells, a soul, which is eternally responsible and made in the image of God, you know, at what point does he do that? You know, what about 5 seconds before they combine, 5 seconds after? Is suddenly that become a person? You've got to figure out what you think about that, haven't you? Okay, are you all being quiet because you're confused by that, or you just don't want to get into that discussion just now? Eh? I guess, apart from the fact that sheep don't have souls, but I understand that. No, I understand you can do the same with humans. I'm with it. It was just a cheap shot. People may have more wisdom on this than me. But I imagine that in a sense it's still kind of analogous that, you know, from a biological point of view, what are we? We are this bunch of materials, just as a materialist would say. What makes us distinctly human and distinct from each other is some act of God, which I guess in his grace he can do in lots of categories of coming into life. Or does anyone have any higher wisdom on this point?
I'm wondering whether there are general principles which we apply, and then there's a point at which we say, these things are too lofty for me.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. It does make sense, but it was too high and lofty, so I didn't understand it. I think you could say that, but in the end, people have got to make really practical decisions, haven't they?
So you need to make it out there. I'm just wondering whether there aren't biblical principles laid down, which mean we don't have to get into the detail. At what point does something have a stone?
Yes.
I think
I just
put that in there.
Yes, the trouble is, you've got you know, and we've got friends, and maybe you've got friends, or maybe you yourselves who've had to make those kind of choices. So it's not out there. Shall I have fertility treatment? So you have to make that choice. So you've got to think something. So it's not out there. It's a choice you have to make sometimes. Do you know what I mean?
I see.
Some things may be so futuristic. Destroyed? Yeah? 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 I would have a view. You might have a view on that. Anyway. There's obviously lots of options, and Christians may differ on that, but they've got to think through it, haven't they? You can't just say, well, I don't know when it becomes a soul. Maybe it doesn't become a soul till it's born. So I can abort it at any time, you could say. So by even saying that, you're forming a view, aren't you? You're kind of frowning and looking anxious. But because you've had to form a view, haven't you? Haven't you?
That's where your free will comes into it.
I don't know. I think it's where God's will comes into it, really.
God and your free will. Yeah. Your free will.
Sure.
He gives you the choice to make these decisions.
Hmm.
It's a huge one.
Ooh. Absolutely. Absolutely. But it is a huge decision, which is why you have to engage with it somehow. And you may be the person making the choice. You may be the person, friend, sister, brother, father of the person making the choice. So it's very real. Now, maybe cloning is not quite so real and apparent and challenging, but some of those other things are. I think we'll say enough about that for the moment, but it does illustrate that it has massive implications, a materialistic view, or not having a materialistic view. Sure, that'll do. What should we talk about now? Shall we think about, without turning pages and cheating, critique a little bit, other than that kind of very important ethical question, critique a bit a materialistic worldview. So someone comes to you with that view, what kind of arguments might you want to mount? Might be something about creation, might be something about redemption, might be something about the future, might be something about the fall. Yeah?
I mean, my take on it is it's a very poor worldview, isn't it? I mean, if you bring up children, I don't know how they work with people, you say, well, actually, life is pretty meaningless, and we die, it means nothing. I mean, to me, that's a very poor, pretty, not exciting, shallow, thank you, shallow, view of life, isn't it? When you, when you part, when I often think to myself, I'm wanting to work, I often think, obviously, Christianity, on one level, is totally crazy, but it's not as crazy as all the other problems.
Yeah.
In a very real way.
Yeah.
So people say, you're mad. And if you think that this is all there is to life, and using the worldview on there, then I would say you're crazy.
Or it's self-satisfaction that this world can do is, let's get the best out of this we can while we're here.
Yeah, you can be married.
Yeah.
Pretty sad, yeah.
Well, if I'm not getting the best out of it, then then that's not great.
Yeah. But even with the world dressing that up, you can see a person who blows all the savings on gambling feels herself thinking. So even the world doesn't really cover up the emptiness of that. And that's even putting a spin on it.
So that's an important point. That speaks to the hopelessness of this view. It's very helpful, and it will be one of the bullets later. So, yeah? It's only a small bullet, so it was very helpful to say, yeah?
A lot of that, of course, relates something to animals, and the idea that a good dog is worth more than a bad person.
Yes.
In other words, when you get old and you can't do what you could do before, well,
we can't, can we?
Huh?
We can't, can we? I can't see as well as I could before.
Well, you know, it comes to the point, well,
yeah.
Let's exterminate, as it were. And, of course, Aldous Huxley was talking about man in ancient essence many decades ago.
So, how does that critique a materialistic worldview?
Because we don't.
Okay, yeah.
I'm trying to think of who I was going to say Stephen Hawking, but that's something quite different.
Yes.
They may have said, well, this is a fetus which needs to be destroyed, and that's happening these days, isn't it? But I'm sure he wouldn't feel that that was the right thing. But it's not the fetus, it's the elderly.
Sure. Yes. Okay.
People don't feel like they've been hanging on to life.
These are all really good points. They're kind of at the philosophical end, but it's all good. Yeah?
With the big stuff, your primary reality,
yes.
The big kingdom of life,
yes.
Cosmos exists. We are all within that system.
Yes.
To be able to say any of that with 100% certainty, you need to be outside that system.
Sure.
Which none of us ever will be.
Yeah.
So you can't say any of that with any form of certainty whatsoever.
No.
Stephen Dawkins, Richard Dawkins,
yes.
Can't say for certain that death is the extinction of life.
No.
Because he's never been outside.
Sure.
The system to check that out.
Yeah.
And he can't.
Yeah.
So that's it.
Yes. There's the famous blind people touching an elephant analogy. I'm sure you've all heard this one, haven't you? Where, in terms of sort of grasping reality, and it's kind of a critique of religions and various views. So there's all these blind people, and they're all kind of coming up and touching an elephant. And so various people, that one feels its trunk, and one feels the tusks, and one feels the tail, and one feels the legs or whatever. So you all get a completely different impression. The reality is the elephant, but we're all kind of getting bits and fragments. But, of course, to be able to even take that view that we're all just getting bits, you have to be able to stand outside and see the whole elephant and the people. So you can't put that forward as a view, because you've got to be outside of the reality to be able to look in and see what the reality is. So yeah, that's another really good philosophical thought. Just give me a few well used, that you're very used to, arguments just about the spontaneous creation not being necessarily a viable idea. Yeah. Yeah. It's the famous philosophical point, out of nothing, nothing comes, which I think is in Latin or something, but anyway, that you can't get some thing from nothing. So there has to be some kind of first cause. And I'm not going to do the thing, because it always confuses people, but you can't philosophically use the infinity argument, because infinity doesn't exist. That's all I'm saying. About infinity. Well, no, because you can do lots of little exercises, some which get very complicated, to prove that infinity is just a construct and that it can't exist. Because one argument out of the, something out of nothing argument is there's just an infinite stream of causes and effects just going on forever, kind of back into infinity. So they just go on forever. But in terms of the knowledge of reality that we have, infinity doesn't make any sense. Because you can't do anything with infinity. You can't use it as a number. You do kind of it's an absurdity. Infinity, it's kind of yes. Sure. There's that argument as well. There's these really clever arguments about people checking into all the odd numbers in a hotel, and then other people checking in all the even numbers. It's some thing like that, you know, and how many people are in the hotel, all sorts of things like that. All the people in the odd numbers leave, how many are left? There's still an infinite number left, aren't they?
An infinite hotel.
Yes. Yeah, but then a new guest arrives, you know, and what happens then? So you can do all these analogies, you see you're getting confused already. They don't really help. You can read books on the absurdity of infinity if you want, but... Yes.
A desire for the spirit, the soul.
Yep.
For some external.
Sure.
Concrete truth in addition to how they experience the world.
Okay. Yes. So if you were to kind of line it up in nice little soldiers, you might say one argument just to do with the creation point is that creation has to have a first cause. So you might get that far with somebody. It has to have a first cause. Why might you think that first cause is personal? Just from our observing the world.
Because there is such a thing as personality.
Yeah, there's two reasons, but yes, yeah.
You don't get matter plus chance plus time equals personality.
Yes. That's on one of my slides. yes. yes, so personality itself is an evidence of a personal creator, but what else might be evidence of a personal, purposeful creator rather than just a kind of deistic kind of first cause?
Would this be where Romans chapter 1 comes in?
No. But it might be, yeah, it might be. Beginning of Romans chapter 1. The beginning of the Romans chapter 1, second section. Yes. Yes.
Through creation.
Yes.
And most people, when they see beautiful, I mean, you know, even something is, but now that I said, has escaped to the country, people see a view in a house and they say, oh, wow.
That's sure. Yeah. Okay. Yep. But yes. Okay. Yep. That's good. That's not what I wanted, but it's good. Another kind of real evidence of a person with purpose. Fine-tuning and design. That's like in your kind of big God arguments, first cause. Evidence of design, they're like key things, personality and morality, as we'll think about in a minute. But design evidence is a really strong thing. Give me, Matthew alluded to it, but...
is this thing about irreducible mechanism?
Well, there's irreducible...
The eye can't exist, it can't evolve.
Sure.
It's a closed system that works.
Yes.
In and of itself.
Yes. Yeah, there's the I, well, just taking them in easy stages. What's the fine-tuning argument, if does anyone know? Yes. There's, I can't remember, can you remember how many? There's a number of parameters, not so much that one, but things like the, what do you call it? The, well, no, not that one. More to do with nuclear numbers, the various ratios that if they weren't in the ratio they were by some minuscule amount, then it wouldn't be possible for life to exist. So the fine-tuning argument is, it's that sense of, you can do all the probability statistics and say, you know, just imagine you're kind of in a control room somewhere and you have, let's say it's 8, I can't remember whether it's 8, but it's something of that number. You've got 8 dials and you just spin them at random and there's a guy just all day spinning them at random. You know, how long would it take for him to get all those dials with the resolution they would need to be to be the fine-tuned thing? You know, to get those all 8 right at the same time. So there's the fine-tuning kind of statistical argument.
Countless planets and star systems and galaxies all the way up. The systems you can also go into your planet.
Sure. Yes. So who's the they would argue? Materialistic view, yeah. 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 So that was the fine-tuning argument, which, you know, obviously none of these are knockout arguments, but they're quite compelling in terms of probability. The irreducible complexity argument, do people immediately understand that, or do you want to talk about that a little bit more? Pardon? That the things like our eye are even the mechanism of cell transportation and messages passing kind of within a cell are so complex there's not a sequence you could get to where there was a viable thing in between. You know, a bird growing a longer beak, you can understand the sequence. You know, they've got a smaller beak and they want to crack open nuts so they get a longer beak or whichever it is. You can understand that's a sequence that works, and that's a kind of microevolution kind of sequence. But being able to create a whole mechanism for cell transportation, you haven't got stages in between where you built half of it and it works. It's a bit like, sometimes I use the analogy of a mousetrap and say, you know, if you're going to build a mousetrap, you're only going to build it kind of a bit of a time, but it had to survive in between. You know, it wouldn't be possible for it to sort of survive. You know, it wouldn't get any mice or whatever and be able to feed itself because in between times you've got to kind of add all the bits and screw them down and everything else and it can't do that to itself without destroying itself in the process. It needs some external force. So that's an argument about irreducible complexity. Other arguments in terms of design, perhaps, or related to that you might know of?
Pushes us to a certain age, it's the complexity issue.
Yeah. Yes. Sure. There's a few more there on the page. We don't need to get into it so much, but the just the fact of order in the universe, it's kind of connected to the design argument, but creating order from disorder is a kind of philosophical difficulty in terms of the evolutionary materialistic argument. And you can read lots and lots to do with information, to do with the creation of information. what's, I'm sure you know, the kind of fundamental information carrier for us. Yeah. And it's the kind of demolition of the evolutionary argument would be to say it doesn't make sense to increase in level of information from nothing to the level of the complexity of DNA. You don't add information. There's also a problem to do with purpose. The classic evolutionary argument is that it's the survival of the fittest argument. It's what gives you an evolutionary advantage to survive. There's a fundamental philosophical point underneath that, which is who says survival is any benefit? Who says that if it's just materials? So, what told that, even if there was, the very first bit of soup, that it was better to be alive than to be dead? Did these cells have a sense of self and worth and value? It's better to live than to die. I have meaning. I have purpose. I need to crawl out of this slurpy, muddy thing because I have a destiny. I have a goal, and there's music playing and stuff. As it kind of emerges, it's philosophically kind of ridiculous because what is purpose? Where does that purpose come from? So that there's no argument to say that there should be. Now, you could say, well, the argument is that it just happens. That would be the evolutionary kind of comeback. But the language that's used is very emotional. To say at all these different stages of evolution, there was a survival advantage. But there's no explanation of why survival matters to anything, any time. What makes the bee think that survival is better? And what makes him decide, life is over? It's, anyway, go on. Simon?
There's a contribution on that, if I may. Because I spent a lot of my life working in environmental science.
Yes.
And I find very fascinating the more is that they would hold to an evolutionary position, but they act like Christians.
Right. Okay.
They don't look at it, when we're about as engineers to destroy habitat, they don't say that's farming, it's survival, because we're critical of the greedy birds. Oh no. So they act like creationists and want to protect those. And I just find that very fascinating.
All the way
across the piece.
Sure.
Why
yeah. Yeah, could be. Yeah, could be. A good argument. I don't understand it well enough. Not really. There is the useful fact that I think it's generally accepted that there was a common ancestry of human beings, which is actually slightly helpful to the creation argument. Rather than a whole series of branches that evolved. That evolution it can be fundamentally racist and all those things, but that all is kind of submerged. But it was a bit extreme. I did read a helpful book about how evolution actually fueled the whole mistreatment of black people, and actually there's examples of it in the States, various slaves being captured and caged, and actually the kind of the evolution argument was used to kind of in favour of their inferiority, and that they must have been in a different branch of the tree and so forth. And behind Nazism and all those sort of things as well. So is that kind of moral? I mean, those are more emotional arguments than necessarily logical ones, but it's all good. We'll talk about personality for a sec, but we have talked about it quite a bit. Right. That was all fine. I just thought you were going that way, and I was thinking there's not a door that way. Good. So the problem of personhood, as in the problem of this worldview, is explaining personhood. We've talked about it quite a bit already, but someone can't be made from something. And I think we intuitively know that our consciousness, our ability to love and hate and love of beauty, as Pam was saying earlier on, and all those things, gives us a sense that we are actually persons and not machines. Now, of course, that argument on its own might not prove anything, because you might just say, well, it's just a construct, but put together with the other points, it becomes significant. I think as Tony was saying, that's supposed to be a little arrow going forwards there. God is personal, so man is personal. That would be our view. We're personal because God is personal. And so there's a source that's personal, so we're source. We are personal. But in naturalism, you've got nothing, the impersonal, time and chance and matter. It doesn't seem that the source for that is sufficient. Little quote from Richard Dawkins, he always deserves a little quote. In a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason to it, nor any justice. The universe we deserve has precisely the properties we should expect. If there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. So that would be the Dawkins view. Of course, he doesn't quite operate according to that, because he thinks Christians are bad, which is fundamentally inconsistent. But he does think Christians are evil, and writes and speaks about it all the time, which of course doesn't make any sense. It is true to say, in that view, in a purist sense, there is no ought. In other words, there's no, it should be this way. There's no sense of what is the good way and what is the bad way. It might be culturally relative or something else. There's no reason for ethics, but we instinctively think ethics matter. So we might have different views about it, but we all think there's such a thing as right and wrong, and we think some things are bad. And those seem to be universals. Although they get corrupted and bent out of shape in different cultures, they are remarkably resilient over the history of mankind, that certain things are considered not good. So, you know, what's the explanation for that? There is no explanation from an evolutionary point of view. All the advantage to the species arguments, you can demolish those. There's some kind of, you know, we're all in a pack, and somehow there's sort of some pack advantage, so morality just kind of arises out of that. But no one's really mounted a convincing case about that. There's, of course, the problem of knowledge, which is kind of a bit of a circular argument. But it's the argument to say that if knowledge is just something that arises out of matter, how do we have any certainty about anything that we know? So we actually need, from a Christian point of view, we would say we need revelation. Why, as I was saying about why do we think there's any such thing as purpose, equally, why is there any such thing as knowledge? Why would these cells in my body even want me to know? So you can become desperately depressed in thinking about this, but you certainly wouldn't become a convinced, adamant materialist, because you really should have no confidence in the knowledge that you have. Sure, yes. Truth, yes. Yeah, truth has no virtue in itself, only in terms of protecting you. So yeah, it has no value in itself. That's a good point. Another quote. If my mental processes are determined wholly by the motion of atoms in my brain, I have no reason to suppose that my beliefs are true, and no reason to suppose my brain is to be composed of atoms, which is the... that kind of circular argument. Charles Darwin quote, which is quite nice. The horrid doubt always arises whether the conviction of man's mind, which has developed from the mind of the lower animals, are of any value or at all trustworthy. Would anyone trust the convictions of a monkey's mind if there are any convictions in such a mind? But I think the reality is there's too much evidence to the reality of knowledge. There's the whole I think therefore I am argument that we can have some confidence about knowledge. I won't give you the tree in a field arguments, which I don't really understand either, but about whether we can truly know something. So there is, I think, sufficient evidence of knowledge existing, but there's no explanation for knowledge naturalistically. So here we go, last couple of slides. Failure of naturalism, I think, to explain the existence at all of the universe. It just says that it exists. It doesn't explain what it is to be human, about rationality, about personhood, and as we've said already, what I was going to talk about if we had time, is fundamentally hopeless as a view. So we can make the arguments about creation in terms of first cause, evidence of design, personhood, morality, knowledge, and we only just got started on creation. Then you can think about fall in terms of is there an adequate explanation for evil? Is just about the earth raging at itself. Is that an adequate explanation of evil and our propensity to evil even when there's no survival benefit? So you can make all those arguments about evil. It's not a good explanation of evil. You can make an argument as to the hopelessness of any redemption offered by that system and in terms of the hope of the gospel. So you're not going to have an hour and a quarter to chat with people, are you? But just maybe some little fragments of this evening might be helpful in speaking with people. I think, well, I remember now what I was going to say when Pam was talking earlier, which is it's true that most people won't have studied secular materialism and thought, yes, okay, this is my whole developed worldview. But they'll have little bits and pieces of it, and it comes out in all kinds of ways. The example I was thinking of earlier was actually to do with people haven't really thought through consciousness necessarily, like the existence of it and knowledge and all those things, but the idea of artificial intelligence seems reasonable when you get, you know, little devices like this that answer you back and seem to have a personality. You know, people haven't really thought through necessarily evolution, but at a popular level, radio programs or TV programs that just assert things build a whole picture. And part of, it's not really the main thing, but part of encouraging people towards Christ is demolishing some of those thoughts, so at least they're receptive to the truth about God. But I think fundamentally, which is really interesting, that was the kind of first argument you made, fundamentally, the greatest demolition to this argument is that it doesn't feel right and it's hopeless. And people are, because of this material view, are really without hope and without God. They're really in that sense of having been given over because they've denied the knowledge that is there and are being given over to sin, even though the knowledge is there. So you're not really trying to necessarily make loads of philosophical arguments and people say, oh yeah, great philosophy, I'm not that convinced. It's more, you're actually speaking to their sole sense that God exists and their utter sense of hopelessness without God. That's what we're trying to speak to as we try and witness to people. And sometimes it's helpful to think about that, otherwise we feel a bit inadequate. Trying to lead them to a sense of wonder at the world that has some basis, rather than just looking at the world and thinking, oh, it's so wonderful, isn't evolution great? Let me briefly pray. I've gone over for 5 minutes, but thanks for listening, and please come back next week. Existentialism, it'll be fun. Let's pray. Lord, help us to be able to speak words which lead people to a sense of wonder at your wonderful creation, and to stop denying your existence, your revelation, your redemption, and your right over people. Give us good conversations, perhaps even in the coming few days, for your glory. Amen.